You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'd just like to thank all of you for showing up today for what is obviously the topic of the moment. I'm Fiona Hill, the Director of the Centre on the US and Europe here at Brookings. And we're here today to talk about Turkey and its role in the Middle East. The Middle East, of course, is the topic that's on everyone's minds. We're delighted to have with us all the way from Turkey, Semih İdiz, the columnist from Milliyet, and also three of Washington's top Turkey experts. Of course, they may all say that, in fact, there aren't that many, but that's not true at all, because quite a few of the other top experts are sitting here in the audience, and we're very pleased that you're all here as well. We have Henri Baki from Lehigh University, and also our neighbour from the Carnegie Endowment. Also, our other, who used to be our neighbour, but now he's moved a little bit closer to the White House, Steve Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations, who, any of you who've been listening to NPR lately will have heard Steve talking quite a lot about Egypt. And our own Ömer Taşpınar here at Brookings, the head of our Turkey project, as well as a professor at the National Defense University. And as I look around the audience, there are a lot of other people I should also probably be introducing. But as this is also going to be a discussion, as we continue with our event this morning, I hope that you will all be able to participate and also we'll introduce you as we go along. We're going to start, first of all, by turning over to Semih. I don't think we need any introduction to the topic. There's just been nothing but press on this issue. Yesterday in the, I think it was the New York Times, there was a long article about Libya, which is also talking about the role of Turkey in a very different way. And Semih, I don't know whether you can touch upon this. It's not just a question of whether Turkey is a future model for the Middle East. It's a question of whether Turkey's been an inspiration for some of the things that have happened. But then there's also the question of Turkey's current role. The piece that I was thinking about yesterday was of all of the construction workers, the guest workers hired by Turkish companies, Turkey being such a major investor in all of the region and people being stranded in Libya. So there was a whole set of dimensions about Turkey there, the role that Turkey was going to play, a lot of questions about whether Turkey might intervene, for example, in Libya. But that's just, of course, only one of the many dimensions that are being raised these days. So we'll turn to you, then I'll ask for comments from Steve. And Steve, if you would also like to talk about Egypt and other issues that have arisen. And then to Henri, and then we'll ask Ömer to wrap up before turning over to the audience. Semih, well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I wasn't expecting to be the first speaker among such eminent people, but seeing as I am, I might as well fire away. To start off with the model thing, I mean, to quote myself, it's not very nice to do so, but I will. Recently, I wrote a piece called Much Ado About the Turkish Model, because, you know, all of a sudden, this Turkish model notion has been pulled out of the bag, and maybe I may have contributed to it myself a little, but I think it's necessary to understand what exactly it is we mean by the quote-unquote Turkish model. In the first instance, of course, this is not a Turkish-invented model as such. It is a European model adopted by Turkey some time ago and evolved according to its own sociological realities. So we're not talking about a sui generis phenomenon whereby Turkey somehow sat down and worked out a model, and now that this model can be a universal thing for the region. It is a model that is the product of what I call the school of hard knocks. It didn't come about easily. It was a model that really took off after 1945 in Turkey when we went into a multi-party system. It is a model that entailed three military coups in the meantime and one what we call a kind of a postmodern coup, which is today is, I think, the anniversary of that, and by some strange coincidence, the prime minister who was ousted in that model actually died yesterday, and they're ensuring that his funeral isn't being held today, but tomorrow. So there's a little irony in there. But nevertheless, you know, what we have today as the Turkish model as such is the product of a lot of sociological dynamics to do with Turkey's extremely heterogeneous structure. And it is very specific onto itself in many ways. So when I really talk about the Turkish model, I think what I'm really referring to is a template. And it's a Western template. It's based on a parliamentary democracy. It's based on secularism. It was adopted from the West, and it was filled in according to Turkey's own realities. So perhaps when we talk about the Turkish model, All we can say about it is that what is interesting vis-a-vis the region is that here is a 99% Muslim country that is implementing this Western model, showing in doing so that factors that are considered to be dichotomous and divergent do not actually have to be so. In other words, of course, I'm referring to the fact of being an Islamic society, but nevertheless being able to maintain a democracy. It has been hard maintaining this democracy in Turkey over the decades, but the difficulties have not stemmed from Turkey's Islamic nature as a society. They have stemmed from other factors, most notably during the Cold War, this big fear of communism, Turkey's frontline position, and those were the issues that stymied this democracy over a certain period, and not, as I say, the fact that, that Turkey is essentially an Islamic country. In fact, if anything, this Islamic flavor and character of Turkey came out more and more as a result of the democratic environment that we have, because, as you know, the AK Party that's in power today was elected completely in a free democratic environment. In fact, one of the freest democratic environments in post-military coup Turkey after 1980. And what the region is now perhaps, or if not the region, the intelligentsia in the region is perhaps studying, is this phenomenon of how a predominantly Turkish society can maintain this democratic, open free market, and to an extent secular system. In my own experience in the Arab world, until fairly recently, I found often that there was no flavor or need or requirement for anything that smacked of a Turkish model in the region. Most people, in fact, in the region generally felt, in my own experience, others may have other experiences, the people I talk to, that Turkey somehow had lost its identity and character by adopting what we call the Turkish model now. In other words, the parliamentary secular system, that it is essentially an Islamic society and its identity had been watered down because of this Western orientation. Now, Turkey's Western orientation is not something that came about automatically in 1923 as a result of Mustafa Kemal and his friends. It's an ongoing process that started at the start of the 19th century and continued throughout the 19th century and is even continuing today to a large extent. So in the past, when you talked about, you know, why don't Arab countries emulate Turkey's path to development and progress, this was not something that really went down very well amongst the Arabs. But now I find quite the opposite. I've been following the English Arab media quite closely over the past 10, 15, 20 days, and I noticed that there are now nuances in the approaches to what Turkey is. One such nuance is coming out of Egypt, of course. They talk about the role of the military in the Turkish model, for example. Now, there we see some relevance for Egypt because we have the same kind of relationship between the people and the military in Egypt that we have in Turkey. In other words, the military is not necessarily a vilified element in Egypt as it isn't in Turkey, despite all the Ergenekon business. It is still considered to be an elemental part of Turkish society. The discussion now is this military dimension in the Turkish model a positive thing or a negative thing? The jury seems to be out on either option. From one perspective, I notice people saying it's actually a negative thing because we have seen in the past that the Turkish military intervened three times and prevented the progress of democracy. And therefore, it's not something to be emulated. It's not something to be copied. From another perspective, again, another Arab dimension, we see people who say, no, no, that's not true at all. The Turkish military has been part of the checks and balances of that society. It is a necessary part of the general composition of Turkey. And if anything, and this is, I think, is an interesting argument, the AKP itself is the product of military interventions, which is a positive thing, because if the military had not intervened the way it did, especially in this postmodern coup of 28 February 1999, I think it
97.
Was. 97. That the Saadet Party or the party, Islamist party of the time, rather, would not have split up, would not have produced a more liberal element from within itself. So, you know, you can take the argument as you like. I don't think that there's anything set and standard. And I, in these social matters, I never see them as a mathematical equation. I don't think there's one clear answer about these things. But it is a fact that what is going on in Turkey or what has been going on in Turkey is something that is attracting more and more attention amongst the people of the Middle East, not necessarily because of the Islamic identity only, but because this provides a template for development, progress, social advancement. Turkey is, of course, still has very serious shortcomings in this respect. There's no point in glossing over these. We have major issues. We have major press freedom issues. We have major minority issues. As I say, we cannot deny any of this. But the level that Turkish democracy has attained, even at this stage, is something that can be taken as an example in these countries. And I think that that we will see more discussion about in the coming weeks and months amongst the Arabs as they try to work out their new leaders, their new system, and whatever. By the way, I don't know how much time I have. We're given that.
A couple more minutes would be great.
Okay, a couple of minutes. Now, a little about Libya. I think many people were very surprised the extent to which Turkey and Libya are involved. Mm-hmm. This is not something that came up overnight, of course. I mean, our involvement with Libya goes back to the 80s. I even have friends who made their first million, to speak, you know, sort of metaphorically, in Libya. Turkish companies have been in Saudi Arabia, in much of the Gulf states, and in Libya for nearly 30 years now. This was part of the takeoff. Because the construction sector and the contracting sector in Turkey was a major dynamic force, was a major locomotive for Turkish development, and Libya was a very important component in this. And hence the reason why we have up to 30,000 citizens there, whether these are workers, whether these are engineers, whether these are the families of workers and engineers, and hence why we have this massive rescue operation going on at the moment. But there is a quandary, and I think we do see the quandary in the somewhat contradictory attitude of our prime minister, who was very outspoken when it came to Egypt, for example, calling on Mubarak to listen to what the people were saying, but is, for his knee-jerk reaction, is to somehow, if not support, but at least to try and defend Libya, I say, under the guise of our economic interests in that country. You know that he opposed sanctions on Libya very strongly, using some very strong language. And yet, we have the vote on Saturday, 15-0, and one assumes that if Turkey was still in the Security Council, as it was last year, that again it would have been left out in the cold, as it was on the Iran sanctions issue last year. So one questions whether our prime minister is really attuned or is in tune with the diplomatic realities of the day. It will be interesting to see how the discussion in Geneva goes today between Ms. Clinton and our foreign minister, Davutoğlu. They will obviously try and coordinate some kind of action because President Obama and Prime Minister Erdogan have had 3 phone calls, if I'm not mistaken, over the past few days discussing Libya. And this goes to show that whatever differences there may be on this issue, that still the two countries feel and believe that they have to cooperate on this. And there are also European countries that want to log into this, Italy and Spain being 2 countries who have a direct interest in Libya, and I noticed that they are also working very closely with Turkey. France is not, but Turkey and France have a serious problem amongst themselves now. Mr. Sarkozy was in Turkey last week, and the vibrations were very negative. They weren't very positive. And this, in a way, is sad because France is also a country with a Mediterranean dimension. As you know, when President Sarkozy came to power, the first thing he unleashed was this project, this Mediterranean Union project, which many in the EU also opposed because they felt that it was a very specifically French project trying to re-energize the French influence over the Mediterranean. But here we have a situation where the Mediterranean is more or less in flames and Turkey is more influential than France in this equation, and countries like Italy and Spain want to cooperate closely with Turkey and America. So this in itself shows that whether Turkey likes it or not, whatever its inclinations may be, it is a player in the region. I liken it a little to a kid who's being pushed on the stage, maybe unwittingly and unwantingly. And I think that this would have happened regardless of whether we have this government in power at the moment, because Turkey has attained a critical mass, both economically and politically and strategically, and this cannot but have some influence in the region. Leaders in the region who are looking for ways out now, I specifically refer to Bashar al-Assad of Syria, are clinging on to Turkey very desperately now. They see that Turkey may provide a way out for them, given that there's even talk of these troubles spreading to Syria. Syria, as I was telling Ari last night, we had a nice discussion, is a country that has the potential to implode very badly. There are problems that have been covered in Syria over the past 20, 30 years. I think the Assad Bashar wants to avoid this, and one way of avoiding this is by developing relations with countries like Turkey. Of course, in his heart of hearts, he has made this very clear in a statement he gave to Guardian last year, that for him, the main arbiter of the region continues to be the United States. He's very keen on trying to be seen with countries like Spain and Italy in the region. But nevertheless, Turkey is also very key, being a Western-orientated country with a growing economy on its borders. I was with Prime Minister Erdogan recently when we went to that country to initiate this for the groundbreaking ceremony of what they call a friendship dam between the two countries, which in itself signified exactly where we had come to with Syria, because it was a mere 10, 15 years ago that we were almost on the brink of war with this country, number one for the PKK issue, because the head of the PKK was taking refuge in Damascus. The Syrians denied us, but I interviewed him there for 4 hours myself, so I know he was there, and also because of the waters of the rivers, because of the Atatürk Dam project in Turkey, Syria felt that it was being deprived of the waters, that its water was being stolen by Turkey, and there was debates about whether it was using the PKK thing against it, but whatever. All of this seems to be in the past now. All is forgotten. They even do not mention the fact that they have this almost irredentist desire to somehow get back Hatay, this Alexandret project, which in their maps still is shown as being part of Syria, but nobody talks about this. And I personally think that this is a positive development because it will be a factor in the quote-unquote taming of Syria. Obviously how the Middle East process goes, whether the Syrian-Israeli track can be reignited and restarted again, this all remains to be seen. But nevertheless, we see a Turkey whose influence is there whether we like it or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Sami. You've certainly covered a great deal of the region there. Steve, turning over to you, you've done a lot of work in the past and also currently on the role of the military. So perhaps that might be a good starting point to think, particularly as Egypt is one of the places that you've looked at very closely, to how relevant the whole Turkish-Egyptian military model is.
You can plug the book.
Well, I was going to turn over to you two.
Yeah. I wouldn't ever do something like that. No, first.
Do you have a copy with you?
No, I don't. I should have brought it. But I don't give anything away free. First of all, thanks very much for the invitation to both you, Fiona, and Omer for inviting me today. It's always nice to come back to the DuPont Circle area after spending so much time in what I've come to call Little Brussels down there near 18th and F. Not a lot of character. When discussing the Turkish model, which has really, as Sim has said, reared its head over the course of the last 3 weeks, the question that I think we really need to ask ourselves, which Turkish model are we talking about? And the Turkish model that I grew up with here in Washington, D.C., was one in which there was a kind of rainbows and unicorns view of the role of the Turkish military as a moderating force in Turkish society, that you know, the military would step in at key moments in order to keep the political system on the rails, and was truly a force for modernization and democratization. I have a different view of that. I think that that narrative only tells part of the story. And that while the Turkish military certainly had an important role to play in the development of Turkey, that at some point it became just a conservative faction holding on to a political system that was no longer as relevant as it once was. And in this sense, it may be relevant to Egypt as Egypt's political system gets back on its feet. But overall, we should see the Turkish military as actually being one